Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast, and happy Monday. I'm Charlie Sykes. We're happy to welcome back Peter Wehner to the podcast. Peter, welcome back.
Thanks for having me on, Charlie. It's always a pleasure.
Well, we have things to talk about. I have to admit that I'm struggling with some things this morning. So I got a text message from somebody with a statement by Donald J. Trump, 45th President of the United States of America. And I'm going to make a confession right now. I thought it was a parody. Okay. So it comes on the letterhead, Save America, President Donald J. Trump. And the statement in full by Donald J. Trump, 45th President of the United States, reads, "The fraudulent presidential election of 2020 will be, comma, from this day forth, comma, known as, all in caps, the big lie, exclamation point." So Donald Trump's been sitting there down in Mar-a-Lago. He's been cogitating and decided that he's going to co-opt the term big lie and turn it around. And from now on, the presidential election is fraudulent and it is the big lie. Wow. Projection is alive and well, isn't it, Mr. Wehner?
It is alive and well. It was alive and well during 4 years that he was president, and the dissent into darkness with him has gotten worse, not better, since he left the presidency. But you're right. I mean, this is the action of both a sociopath and a demagogue, which is to appropriate the term. He himself has been perpetuating this big lie. And there is something about Trump, some kind of instinct that he has, which has a certain genius with his base, which is to try and take the very thing that he's guilty of and accuse others of being guilty of it. The most depressing thing about this isn't that Trump would call this the big lie. The most depressing thing is that the overwhelming number of Republicans today will say that it's the big lie as well. And basically, he sets the script and they follow it. That's the really damaging thing that's going on right now.
Yeah, I guess the genius is his ability to dumb down the debate. And of course, the last time that I can, well, I mean, this happened many, many times, but I certainly recall his appropriation of the term fake news. Yep. I wonder how many people even remember that fake news was the phrase that was used to describe the Trumpist disinformation and misinformation that we were getting back in 2016. And he just simply turned it around. So let's stick with this. Okay, so Peter, did you watch this video of Trump at the open mic night down at Mar-a-Lago? He's out on the path. This is one where, again, we're in the, is this a parody or is this real? We actually labeled the audio of this the wedding singer, because he's standing out on the patio in front of a microphone. There's a band there, and he seems to have wandered out into a party. And he goes off on this rant about the election. And he's obviously fixated on this completely absurd, ridiculous, ludicrous recount that's being done in being done in Arizona. And he seems to imply this is the beginning, I don't know, of unraveling the whole election. So I want to play this and get your thoughts on it, Peter. This is Donald Trump at the open mic night at Mar-a-Lago.
Let's see what they find. I wouldn't be surprised if they found thousands and thousands and thousands of votes. So we're going to watch that very closely. After that, you'll watch Pennsylvania and you'll watch Georgia and you're going to watch Michigan and Wisconsin and you're watching New Hampshire. They found a lot of votes up in New Hampshire just now.
You saw that? No.
Because this was a rigged election. Everybody knows it. And we're going to be watching it very closely. But start off by, you just take a look. It's on. It's on closed circuit. I guess it's on all over the place because everyone's talking about yesterday, front page of the New York Times. They didn't want to write it, but that's because they thought they were going to have a negative decision, and the judge gave us a positive decision.
Now, let's see. Oh, so Peter, I've watched this several times, and I have the hard time thinking this through. I mean, imagine watching that and saying, "Yes, that's our leader. We believe him. We follow him. Let's put him back in the Oval Office."
Right. Yeah, no, that's so true, Charlie. I mean, the first thing I suppose that needs to be said is how pathetic and sad this is. I mean, this is a person who is simply not well. He's psychologically unwell. He is obsessing, and as you said, fixating on this election. It's fascinating psychologically to consider what happened because of his narcissistic personality disorder that Trump had. He cannot process the notion that he's failed at anything. And of course, he failed in the presidential election. And this created such profound cognitive dissonance that he simply couldn't accept it. And this is how it's working its way out. But this is a diseased mind that we're seeing play out. And as you said, I mean, that in and of itself would be bad enough. But the fact that he has so many followers.
Well, that's the thing.
Right, who have you know, this is the kind of cult of personality. The other thing I'll say is,
yeah, but wait, it's a cult of personality, but it's the cult of this personality. This is the thing about it, is that it's kind of old news that he's narcissistic and pathological and everything, but that you have tens of millions of people who go, yeah, this is great, that you have the entire Republican establishment, you know, from Kevin McCarthy on down, who are basically going, unless you are loyal to this guy, we are going to purge you. This is, and believing this stuff has become the absolute litmus test for survival in the Republican Party. Okay, so Donald Trump is crazy. That does, frankly, no longer bothers me as much as watching everything that's happened, everything that's played out, watching that and going, yeah, we're into that, and everybody needs to get on board this stuff.
Yeah, I entirely agree. I mean, one of the tragedies of the Trump presidency, and one of the most important things that I think was overlooked too often was not Trump himself, as you say. It was that the appeal that Trump had, that these pathologies, this psychological sort of breakdown that we saw time and time again, was not news to anybody. It's the fact that it resonated. And of course, the reason that the political leadership supports Trump isn't because they don't know better. Chris Christie knows better. Kevin McCarthy knows better. A lot of them know better. It's the fact that the base demands fealty to Donald Trump, and they know it. And so this is a game that's going on. It's a sort of dangerous synergy. The base itself has been radicalized and Trumpified and is living in an alternative reality. And the political leadership, because they don't want to go crosswise of the base, is reinforcing it. And so you're living in this world that is utterly detached from reality.
Well, and let's have an example of this. Over the weekend, I think probably everybody listening to this podcast knows about this. Mitt Romney is speaking at the Republican convention in Utah, and this is what happened. Again, this is Mitt Romney, former presidential nominee of the Republican Party, former Republican governor, son of a Republican governor, a solidly conservative record. He stands up at the Republican convention. This is what happens.
So what do you think about President Biden's first 100 days? Now, you know me as a person who says what he thinks, and I don't hide the fact that I wasn't a fan of our last president's character issues. And I'm also no fan. Aren't you embarrassed?
Okay, so Peter, that I made that the subject of my newsletter this morning, my Morning Shots newsletter. That question, aren't you embarrassed? Because that seems to be the question here. How is the Republican Party not thoroughly humiliated by what it's becoming? But isn't this moment that we're in right now, where Marjorie Taylor Greene and Matt Gaetz are Republicans in good standing, and Mitt Romney and Liz Cheney are pariahs?
Yeah, boy, that is so true, and that just shows you the degraded state of the Republican Party. That was an amazing scene in Utah over the weekend with Mitt Romney for several reasons. One you mentioned, which was he was the nominee in 2012. The other thing is that Utah Republicans were among the least loyal Trump Republicans during his presidency. A lot of Mormons actually took their faith commitment seriously, and there was some distance between them and the character of Trump. But I think that this illustrates something that I'm guessing that you agree with, which is that the party now is more radicalized and more Trumpified since he left.
Yeah.
I had conversations with with friends after Trump was defeated. These are responsible conservatives, and they were hoping for a snapback to the Republican Party, that it would go back to what it was pre-Trump and become a sane party again. And that was a delusion, because I don't think that they fully understood that the poisons had been unleashed. And weirdly, Trump, I'd say in the latter half of his presidency, might have become a kind of a restraining force on the Republican Party. Not at the beginning, because I think that he radicalized the party and sort of unleashed these poisons I was describing. But at some point, it was imbibed. And Trump, I think, at least when he was president, gave these people some sense of security. Now that he's gone, it's a free-for-all. All these freaks are trying to outdo each other, with Josh Hawley and Ted Cruz and on, trying to become, you know, mini Trumps. So I think the Republican Party is more radicalized, as I said, now than it was during the Trump years. And what's unfolding as it relates to Liz Cheney in particular in the House is a really big deal.
Well, let me read you what you wrote in the Atlantic. It was the last week in April, and I feel like there was a recognition right about the time that you wrote this that, wow, it, you know, not only did the fever not break, but as you just said, it's getting worse. What you wrote was, the hope of many conservative critics of Donald Trump was that soon after his defeat, and especially in the aftermath of the January 6th insurrection, the Republican Party would snap back into its former shape. The Trump presidency would end up being no more than an ugly parenthesis. The GOP would distance itself from Trump and Trumpism and become a normal party once again. But that dream soon died. The Trump presidency might have been the first act in a longer and even darker political drama in which the Republican Party is becoming more radicalized. How long this will last is an open question. Whether it is happening is not. Peter, that's a gut punch. Because I don't think that, you know, many of us really thought that everything would go back to normal right away. But I have to admit that particularly in the hours after January 6th, to imagine that the Republican Party would become even worse, even darker, even more hostile to democratic norms and separated from reality, I don't think we saw that coming. But I think you're right here. So let's spend a little time on all of this. You know, I know it sounds counterintuitive to say that Trump was a restraining force, but at least there was like a focal point, right? There was at least he was crazy, but at least he was there, and so you weren't going to get too much crazier. But now it's like you know, everybody's freelancing, and there's a competition for who is the most bizarre. It's Tucker Carlson versus OAN. It's Ted Cruz versus Josh Hawley. And there's this constant sidestep to the crazier. And all of the incentives are for the crazy. So not only are there no sanctions for the people who buy into the lies and the deception and the conspiracy theories. In fact, it's the opposite. Those people actually raise more money and become more famous. And the people who actually push back against it are the ones who are being purged. But so it is getting worse, and it is getting more and as a result, the Republican Party is more dangerous even than it was under Trump.
Yeah, I think it is. I think it's the main danger politically to the country, by far, right now. And you know, as you mentioned, there is an incentive here to act in a crazy way. Marjorie Taylor Greene, I think in the first quarter, raised $3.2 million, which is a staggering sum, particularly for a freshman to have. And she's more popular in the party than Liz Cheney is. And I what's going on, I think, is that people, for the most part, I think, have resisted acknowledging, really, almost through, not you per se, but I would say a lot of people who are Republicans, just how deep the pathologies in the Republican Party went, and honestly, they predated Donald Trump. It's Donald Trump was in a sense a creation of those things. That opened the opportunity for him to become president, and then he accelerated all the worst tendencies. He was a pernicious force for sure. But it unlocked it. It sort of opened Pandora's box. The other thing I think that's happened is that Trump won 10 million more votes in 2020 than 2016. Yeah. Republicans gained in the House. I think the one chance that might have had that the Republican Party could shake itself of Trump, and that the leadership, the political leadership, of the Republican Party would have broken from him, is if they would have been wiped out, from stem to stern. That didn't happen. They lost the presidency, but as I said, they gained 10 or so seats in the House. I think they gained one governorship. They did well in the state legislatures and so forth. And so what happened is that the Republican Party, the leadership of the Republican Party, the political leadership, feels like they threw their hat over that wall, and their best chance to gain power is to stay with Trump, not to stand up to him. That's certainly the calculation that Kevin McCarthy has. There was that brief window, as you alluded to, right after January 6th, the insurrection, where there was some movement away from him. But that lasted, 48, 72 hours. But again, what the members of Congress saw was how the base was reacting, and they saw this devotion to Trump, and nothing was going to shake it. Nothing shook it for 4 years, not even an insurrection and an effort at a coup shook it. And what we're seeing here has to be understood not politically, but psychologically. I mean, I really mean that, and I think I probably learned more about politics in understanding and having conversations with psychologists over the last several years than politicians. Because
same
what
here.
We're seeing now has to be understood in a psychological term. The grievances on the American right, the siege mentality, the sense of existential fear, the hatred for the left, this desire to own the libs, to do anything that irritates liberals or progressives is by definition something that needs to be done, this journey into a world of unreality. Those are psychological phenomena more than they're political phenomena. What we're seeing, of course, is it manifests itself politically, but that's not what's driving it.
So the headline on your Atlantic piece was, "The GOP is a grave threat to American democracy." And the subhead was, "Unless and until Republicans summon the wit and the will to salvage the party, ruin will follow." So what would the wit and will look like? I'm struggling with this because, I've thought all along that if certain thought leaders, responsible folks, stood up and said, stop, stand athwart the crazy and said, you can't be serious about this, that it might make a difference. I no longer know who that would be and how it would work.
Yeah, I agree. I think it is very difficult. Look, Charlie, it may be the case that this is a virus that simply has to run itself, or a fire that has to run itself out. And that just may take some period of time. And at this point, the fire is uncontrolled and there's not a lot that can be done about it. That doesn't mean that individual leaders within the Republican Party and governors, people like Larry Hogan and Governor Cox in Utah and others shouldn't speak out. And life is a theater of vicissitudes, John Adams said. Things can change. There are inflection points often that you don't anticipate. All that any of us can do is be faithful. That doesn't mean we'll be successful. And we'll just have to see how things unfold. But if you use this metaphor of a fire, there are times in which a fire is simply out of control and you have to wait it out. Now, maybe there are things that can be done among political leaders and others who can accelerate the process in a positive way. But right now, it's really tough. I do think that if the collective leadership of the Republican Party did speak out, it would have some effect. In the short term, it would be very contentious because the base would get angry. But I just think that you have to speak truth to power and you have to hope and trust that the truth will out. But I understand your point and I think I agree with it. Right now, at this particular moment, I don't know that there's any way to get this contained, at least for the time being. It may be that something like what happened to the British Labour Party has to happen to the Republican Party. You'll remember the British Labour Party in the late 70s and 80s up through the early 90s was a deeply radical party. And they had to lose and lose badly election after election after election to Margaret Thatcher most of the time. And that created an opening for Tony Blair and New Labour. And he reformed the party pretty quickly, and he won a lot of elections. But that took time. And Bill Clinton did something similar with the Democratic Party, you know, from 72 to 88. They were crushed in almost every election, minus 76, which, of course, had the backdrop of Watergate. So sometimes the only thing that can do this are a series of thumping defeats. And the Republican Party hasn't experienced that yet. And 2020, unfortunately for it, was not a thumping defeat.
Well, in 2022, they may take back the House. My sense is that there's a reason why you're not seeing any sort of an autopsy or any sort of looking in the mirror, because they're pretty comfortable with where they're at right now. I also am a little bit concerned that the Democrats may be overreading the mandate. The control of American government is determined not just by the base, it is determined by, you know, certain swing voters in certain swing states. And so I do worry about this. See, I have a specific question for you. Again, going back, one of the things, and I'm sure you've done the same thing, is to keep asking, you know, what were the turning points? How did we get here? You and I were both part of a conservative movement that we thought was pretty sensible, pretty rational, and which has been exposed as being neither. But you have Joe Biden, who is proposing the most massive increase in spending that we've seen since, say, the Great Society, a really dramatic, and I'm not saying this in a pejorative way. I mean, you know, we're talking about massive increases in the role of the federal government, really rolling back the entire Reagan revolution. What strikes me, and I wrote about this over the weekend, at least when it comes to the conservative grassroots, there's nothing like the Tea Party focusing on the spending, the size of government. All of the energy is now in the culture war. Right. So it's also a shift in what conservatives care about. I mean, they care about cancel culture, but you're not seeing people, you know, having protests about healthcare, about the debt, and about the deficit. So I guess this raises the question, in retrospect, what was the Tea Party actually about?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I take it that at least on some level, it was the tail end of some elements of the conservative movement, which was the limited government. Remember, the Tea Party came out of the financial crisis of 2008-2009. Right. And often you see a kind of populist movement, which is what I think fundamentally the Tea Party was. I don't think it was a conservative response as much as it was a populist response. And it was anger that the banks had been bailed out. Now, actually, the TARP plan, the plan that bailed out the banks, was, I think, in retrospect, a very successful program. It kept us from going into a deep depression, and that all of that money was paid back. But that was, in a sense, beside the point. It was this notion that the Wall Street. But by the way, you'll know this better than most people. What we began to see, I would say, in the sort of 2000s, mid-2000s, if you listened on talk radio, this was a kind of canary in the coal mine to me, and I imagine it was for you too. As you know, so Rush Limbaugh, to take him as an illustration, because he was clearly the most important radio talk show host in history. So he goes national in 88, all through the 90s, early 2000s. The binary was liberal conservative for Rush Limbaugh and all of the acolytes and all of the people who basically followed Limbaugh. But then, sort of in the mid to 2000s, end of the 2000s, early 2010, it shifted to establishment, anti-establishment.
Right.
The party began to drift from conservative to populist. And conservatism and populism are not synonymous. And in many cases, often they're antithetical to one another. And so the Republican Party became not conservative, but populist and angry populist. And at the same time, you had this distancing itself from the party of ideas. You and I were formed sort of in the shadow of the Reagan Revolution, where there were serious ideas, you know, Alan Bloom and the Closing of the American Mind, and Richard John Newhouse and the Naked Public Square and Losing Ground, and Antonin Scalia and the Federalist Society. There was a kind of pride that we took in being conservatives, because we thought there was an intellectual rigor to conservatism. Now, that wasn't all of conservatism, but that was a lot of it. And there became and grew an anti-intellectual movement, and you could see it gain steam. And of course, it personified itself in some respects in 2008 with Sarah Palin, mm-hmm. when she became a kind of rock star. She was clearly more popular with a base than John McCain was, and she had no acquaintance with any ideas. So it was populism, and when populism catches on like this and ventures into these more pernicious forms, it's bad stuff for the country. And right now, the Republican Party is concerned completely with sort of the performance aspect of politics. The idea of serious governing, of a serious agenda, is out the window. We saw that in 2020 because there was not even a platform.
Which is pretty much a tell. No, what you're describing is absolutely right. And it's not just you said the angry populism. It was that rise of that perpetual outrage machine, where all of the energy was spent in getting people angry and often angry at Republican leaders who were trying to explain to the base what was possible and what was not possible. The whole idea of governing, of compromise, really became was really thrown out. So, I mean, that goes back to the Tea Party, because I think you saw a little bit of that. And I know that there are some of our liberal listeners who think that the Tea Party was all about the fact that Barack Obama was a black president and it was, always racist. But, there's a little bit of truth to everything, but the Tea Party was a lot of different things. In the beginning, there was a genuine grassroots element, not totally. A lot of it was funded by, Americans for Prosperity through the Koch network, but they were concerned about small government and government spending. And then over time, it kind of morphed into something that was taken over by this new generation of entrepreneurial grifters and then the extremists and the kooks. And now we have sort of vestiges of the Tea Party that have nothing really to do with small government or fiscal conservatism. They're completely Trumpy. They're completely culture war. They're completely into sort of, performative outrage all the time. So you can kind of trace that, through that movement, because, I went back over the weekend. I was looking at some of the signs from the Tea Party movement, and you would think these people were really concerned about government spending and debt and deficits. And that just seems like kind of a sick joke now.
Yeah. Well, you would have thought once upon a time, Republicans cared about character in presidents and public officials too, as you recall. Well, I remember in the, late 1990s, every day Republicans were taking a 2x4 against Bill Clinton because of his immoral conduct with Monica Lewinsky. I was one of them. I was critical of that, not just for the act itself, but that he lied under oath. And people like Al Mohler pushed the Southern Baptist Convention to pass resolutions about the importance of character in public life. What did Al Mohler do in 2020? He said he's voting for Bill Clinton. By the way,
Donald Trump.
Oh, Donald Trump.
Yeah.
He voted said he would vote for Donald Trump in 2020. So you've seen a reversal on any number of issues. You mentioned, limited government, the deficit and the debt, which exploded pre-COVID, exploded under Trump. The Republican Party used to be the party of free trade. It became a protectionist party under him. It made morality a centerpiece of foreign policy. That was the great debate in part between Reagan and Nixon, right? Realpolitik versus Reagan's rollback of communism and making morality central to the foreign policy and national security cause. And what was Trump about? He was having this bromance, this love affair with probably the most brutal dictator in the world, Kim Jong-un, and these other autocrats. So the Republican Party has completely flipped from what it was. I don't consider it, by the way, and I don't think you do either, a conservative party. I think conservatives now are politically homeless. It's just of things. And I think that in many respects, in some deep fundamental respects, the Republican Party is less conservative than the Democratic Party, at least when it comes to temperament and disposition, which is a very important core element of conservatism. It's as we've been talking about, it's a radicalized party and it's an anti-institutional party. The idea that a conservative party or a conservative would be a member in good standing of an institution of a party that is anti-institutional just doesn't square.
I mean, just on this issue of Trump and the deficit, the numbers are pretty remarkable. He presided over the ballooning of the national debt from $19.9 trillion to around $28 trillion, which is an increase of more than 35% in just 4 years. So not a surprise that Republicans would, you know, they go through the motions of talking about socialism. Not sure what they actually mean by socialism all the time, but they do it. But your point about that the Republican Party is no longer conservative, that it has become more radicalized, it feels more like the European right wing in some ways than an American, an American conservative party. But give me your sense then about how you're feeling about Joe Biden, because of course Joe Biden is, you know, feels more like an FDR than even a Barack Obama. So where do conservatives go? I mean, your sense. I mean, in terms of his disposition and his style, he seems much, I mean, he actually, there's a certain conservatism in his and his respect for institutionalism and everything. But the policies, I don't think it would be fair to say are conservative in any way.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think Biden is something of a mixed bag. I should say when I think about Biden, I would disaggregate. The first thing I say is I'd rate him very, very high on deportment, on conduct. And after 4 years of Donald Trump, that matters a great deal, more than it ever has.
A lot.
We have a president who's a sociopath or an insurrectionist. Now, that used to, once upon a time, that wasn't anything you would really have to factor in. But today it is. And I actually think that the conduct of Joe Biden, the person of Joe Biden, is important. I mean, I think he's a dignified person. He's an individual with great personal empathy. He's dialed the rhetoric down, especially compared to Trump. And I think he's trying to depolarize things. And by and large, I think is a kind of healing agent in our politics. And I think that matters. I think it matters a lot. So that's one. The second thing is that the most immediate and main task that he faced coming into office was inroads against COVID. And there, I think he gets pretty high marks for the vaccine distribution effort, and the messaging, I think, has been good. When you go beyond that to his domestic policy and his foreign policy, and then let's call it the sort of the culture policies, there I think it's more mixed. He's much too profligate for my taste. I'm not sure that he's spending it wisely. I'm a big fan of the child tax credits.
Mm-hmm.
I like direct subsidies. I think that the evidence is pretty overwhelming. That's the way to go. But the amount of money is huge. And I look, I'm at my, I guess in my core, something of a reform conservative. And when you're spending this amount of money, and it's possible David Brooks has made this point, which is his implied diagnosis, Biden's, is that what's happening in the country is a series of structural problems, the inequality, the social fragmentation, and the social distrust. And it may require a once-in-a-generation investment. Now, that may or may not be right. If it's right, then I would be much more comfortable if Biden was advocating the reform of what I think are broken institutions, the modernization of those institutions, so the money is going to be used more effectively. And then there's a question of the debt. Now, I don't pretend to understand anymore what the inflection point is at debt.
No.
When does a debt actually cut and begin to cause serious economic damage? I think most people, if you would have talked in the late 80s, and you would have given a figure like this, they would have said that this would have led to an economic catastrophe, and it's not. On foreign policy, I think it's mixed. I think he's steadied our relationships with the allies. He signaled to our adversaries and despotic leaders that the days of that bromance I was referring to are over. He acknowledged the Armenian genocide, the commitment to Taiwan, he said, is rock solid. I think that's good. He's condemned the persecution of the Uyghurs in China. So those are all good. My biggest concern at this point is Afghanistan. I think the withdrawal of the troops there is probably unnecessary. I think it'll have, certainly from a humane perspective, a lot of damage. But I think it may hurt us geopolitically. And I think that Biden was just ideologically committed to leaving there. I don't think that the facts on the ground argued for it. I think the downside of leaving are higher than the upside. And then the last thing I'll say, Charlie, sorry for being long-winded here, but I don't think Biden himself is animated by the culture war or wokeness. He's not from that generation. But the Democratic Party itself, the energy of the Democratic Party is certainly there. And Biden has supported things like the Equality Act, which has to do with gays, lesbians, transgender. I oppose an alternative, the Fairness for All Act, because I think the Equality Act is a real threat to religious liberties. And I do think that you know, the defund the police rhetoric that you hear, that's not Biden's rhetoric. I think he's been pretty responsible. But that energy in the Democratic Party is there. And I'm concerned, and I know you are too, with this cancel culture, wokeness. I know those are imprecise terms, but we basically know what we're talking about, which is a sort of totalizing ideology. And it's a notion, you see this, you know, it was confined to the academy for years and years. But it's now spread to journalism and other areas of public life. I think it's wrong. And I also think that it's going to unnecessarily divide the country. So I'm not a progressive. I'm a conservative. I think Biden has done, you know, reasonably well, quite well in some areas, reasonably well in others, not so well. But we're going to see if by the end of this year, if we've got a sane person who's president, if the pandemic is in retreat, if the economy is growing at 6%, if businesses and schools are open, if we suffered no international crisis or terrorist attack, and if the administration isn't marked by corruption or lawlessness, you'd have to judge that to be a pretty good first year. We're conservatives, you and I, and so we believe in human experience, and we believe in what the facts and the realities say. And so we're just going to have to see how this plays out.
No, I agree with you. And you know, you touched on this. One of the things that after 2016, actually before 2016, I tried to make the case to our friends on the left that they needed to take the issue of religious liberty much more seriously, that issue was off the radar screen for a lot of people, and yet was one of the driving forces forcing people to the right and voting for Republicans, because there was a sense that, okay, we're willing to go along. I think there was a willingness to go along with many of the shifts on gay marriage and other things. But if you had a carve out for religious belief, you would come to a sustainable compromise. But it felt like instead you had some of the culture warriors at ramming speed, and I think they've paid a price for all of that. And I continue to be concerned about that. But to your point about optimism, you know, I'm looking at this new poll, ABC News Ipsos poll that came out yesterday, asking Americans, do you feel optimistic about the next year in the United States? And 64% said they felt optimistic, only 36% said pessimistic. Now, that is a dramatic turnaround. And if Joe Biden succeeds in getting people to feel more hope, to feel more optimistic, if in fact we do get a handle on the pandemic, if the economy does grow at a 6% rate, you know, if the schools reopen, then this has been a very, very good first year for him. And all of the you know, inside baseball issues back and forth won't matter that much. I think there might be even a little bit of a shadow of an era of good feeling, not to say that we are not still bitterly divided and we don't have real threats to democracy. But given everything that's happened to this country, for 2/3 of Americans right now to say they are optimistic is quite a thing. And Joe Biden deserves a lot of credit for that.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think part of it is simply being not Donald Trump, but I think he really has conducted himself. If you think of a president as both head of government and head of state, I think as head of state, Biden has done extremely well. You know, that poll underscores, I think, one of the problems for the Republican Party, because the country, generally speaking, is becoming more optimistic. But the Republican Party and the base of the party in particular, including a lot of white evangelicals, is going in exactly the opposite direction. They are seized by a kind of existential fear. And when you have a party or a base of a party that is out of touch with the majority of the country, that creates the quandary that the Republican Party is in, because you're not going to win primaries by spitting in the wind of the base, but the base itself is out of touch with the party. And so as the country overall gets more optimistic, the Republican Party is becoming more angry and more concerned. By the way, I wanted to say one other thing just to reinforce something that I saw you had said this morning, I think on Morning Joe, which was Ronald Reagan. I thought about it because you mentioned optimism, and that was such a central part of who Ronald Reagan was, really at his core. He was a man of such sort of fundamentally sunny disposition. And I think you had said that, you know, if he ran today, he wouldn't win. I don't think there's a chance that he would be the nominee, because Reaganism and Ronald Reagan himself, I mean, fundamentally who he was as both dispositionally and temperamentally and in terms of his governing philosophy, is utterly out of step. He was a man of grace, of good humor, and his attitude, the attitude that informed his views on immigration was America being, as we know, shining city on a hill, a place of where it invited the strangers and the aliens and made them welcome. And he was not angry. He was almost never angry. And Trump himself is nothing but radiating anger. And so is the base. And it is pretty amazing. And so anyway, I wanted to say, just to reinforce and applaud what you said, I don't think there's any chance that Reagan or anybody running like a Reagan would win the nomination. We saw some of that in 2016, right? Which is there were a whole, that was a pretty impressive field of 16 in 2016.
Well, we thought so.
At the time.
Was that? We thought so at the time.
Yeah. Well, I actually think it was pretty impressive. It's just that they were running in a party that was looking for Donald Trump. And I think that's a condemnation not of them, but of the people who wanted Donald Trump.
Well, you articulated this much better than I did, but I really do feel strongly that we need to understand how far this party has moved from Reaganism. That Reagan could not win a primary these days because of the disposition, because of the temperament, because he doesn't feed that outrage machine. But also, and again, very specifically because of his attitude toward immigration, but he was also willing to do things that are no longer acceptable, including things like compromise, work with Democrats, put together bipartisan packages. People forget when he became, you know, president, Democrats controlled Congress, and yet he was still able to push through much of his agenda. But also, that's a very, very different era. We didn't have the entire infrastructure, the infrastructure of the outrage machines. We didn't have the media ecosystem that demanded, you know, a constant flow of anger and vitriol, and that was constantly ginning up outrage. So it is interesting, the number of conservatives who try to pretend somehow that what we're seeing now is not a repudiation of Reaganism. You know, it's interesting, you know, the Young Americas Foundation, headed by my old fellow cheesehead, Scott Walker, who has become very, very, very Trumpy. And yet, you know, they own the old Reagan ranch, and they continue, even though they're pushing a thoroughly Trumpified agenda. They just brought on Stephen Miller as one of their featured guest speakers. They still try to pretend that you know what they're representing is not this fundamental in your face repudiation of the man whose name they invoke all the time.
Yeah. You know, it just struck me in this conversation. This is really, really kind of going back to the day, but Reagan was criticized by the right, by people like Howard Phillips and Richard Viguerie. And what happened now is that the Howard Phillips and Richard Viguerie's have basically dominated the party. I mean, they've left their input, along with, I would say, Pat Buchanan, who I think was a much more significant figure than any of us realized at the time. The Buchanan run for the presidencies in 92 and 96 really foreshadowed Trump in almost every important respect. I would say if you wanted to understand Trump and Trumpism, the two figures probably to look at would be Pat Buchanan and George Wallace. I think that combination of individuals explains who Donald Trump is and the rise of Trump, and why I think ultimately Trumpism will fail. I think it needs to fail for the sake of the Republic.
So one last comment to sort of loop around to where we began, but I thought it was a parody that Trump put out a statement saying that he was going to from now on call the election the big lie. It's interesting what's happened to the state of language, and I'm sure you've thought about this. When Mitt Romney is speaking in Utah, they were yelling two names at him. They were calling him a traitor and a communist. And it would be interesting to know, what did these Utah Republicans think the word communist meant? You know, it actually used to mean something. It had a real tangible reality. And now it's just obviously a freeform insult, because in what sense is Mitt Romney a communist? He's a traitor only in the sense that he's not loyal to Trump's lies and to his character. But it is interesting the way language has just been battered and twisted and distorted. And I suppose that would be another indication of the derangement of the conservative mind and of the drift toward authoritarianism, where words mean what we want them to mean rather than having any sort of discernible, real, objective meaning.
Yeah, I so agree with you, Charlie. And in a book that I did in 2019, The Death of Politics, I actually devoted part of a chapter to the power of words. You know, George Orwell wrote, I think it was in 1946, a very powerful essay on the destruction of language and political language. And the corruption of language is a manifestation of the corruption of thought, and vice versa. I mean, they interact with each other. And Orwell is a very important figure for your listeners to go back to and read and study, because of the obvious Orwellian elements that we're seeing. And words matter. Words are among the most powerful things in human life, and all you have to do is to think back of books and poems and things that move the human heart and shape the human sensibilities. And even if you think about great presidents, often people think of them not because of their public policy position so much as words. You know, Lincoln with malice toward none, with charity toward all. John F. Kennedy, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. Reagan, tear down this wall, Mr. Gorbachev. FDR, we have nothing to fear but fear itself. There's a reason that those words resonate. Because words are windows into the soul, and the right words can elevate our sensibilities, our moral sensibilities. They can lead us to see beauty and goodness. And the corruption of words can do the opposite. It can pull us down, and it can corrupt our sensibilities. And we're in a period right now, a really difficult and hard and low period in American history. And the degradation of words is a manifestation of that. This country has a lot of repair to do. I have a friend who years ago said you could be a theoretical pessimist, but you need to be an operational optimist. I think we need to be operational optimists. And as I said earlier, each of us individually just has to be as faithful as we can to the good, to the moral good, to the common good, and hope that this country, which you know, has had such a remarkable history of its capacity for self-renewal, is one of the wonders of human history. But this is a tough moment right now.
Peter Wendt, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today. Peter is, of course, a contributing writer at The Atlantic and a senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. Good to have you back, Peter.
Thanks, Charlie, and thanks for all your work. It makes a difference. I appreciate it.
And thank you all for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again. All right, that was great.